And welcome into Priced Out, the podcast, a podcast about gentrification. And I'm your host, Andrew Morgan. And with me is Cornelius Swart, the filmmaker, producer, and I mean, just what are you not? Like, it's so many different things, but today he's a co-host.
Today I'm co-host, and that's good for me. You're doing a great job.
So today we're going to talk about about Tulsa a little bit. Not a little bit. Today's whole show is about Tulsa, which is an interesting city to talk about when it comes to gentrification. It's especially interesting for me because I've spent the last, well, I spent 16 years in Tulsa. So quite some time.
So you're
time.
Kind of from Tulsa, and we just heard the Gap Band, which is, from they Tulsa. Are like Tulsa's homegrown boys.
Yeah, Greenwood, Archer, and Pine. That's what the GAP stands for in Gap Band. Now, a lot of people don't really know that, but it's one of the places that is, if you know the history, it's one of the greatest things to be proud of. It's so much heritage. It's one of the communities in America that you could say there is a real life history and heritage that you can be proud of. There's some horrible things that happen, true enough, but the resilient nature of the people, they have a rich heritage that, to be honest with you, I am proud to say that I lived in Tulsa and I was closely connected to that community.
And I don't think a lot of people know about that history.
Yeah.
The Gap Band notwithstanding, just the history of Greenwood and Oklahoma in general, the African-American tradition and history in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and so, like, for me, I learned a lot. I used to take pictures for the, we would have these black town tours that the Tulsa Library would put on. And so I got a chance to learn firsthand from historians like Hannibal Johnson and other people in the community, where they would teach us why these towns were named black towns, that at one point the U.S. government had wanted to designate Oklahoma black land and put nothing but Native American reservations and towns specifically set up for African Americans to dwell. And it was described in papers as a land of savages. And so as a result, it didn't really go over well, because there was this image of, well, they're just going to get in there and they're going to get bigger and powerful and then they're going to spread out and rape our women. And so there was some horrible imagery that was put out there in order to combat that from actually happening. And then, of course, they discovered oil.
And before it became a state, they discovered oil, or right around the time.
Yeah. And so as all of that happened, the idea of making this a black land, it absolutely went away. There was a state that was predominantly, I've heard figures, and so I can't say this for sure, but I've heard figures that they said this was a state that was up to 80% Native American and black at one point. But once the discovery of oil took place, the population numbers completely flipped with statehood and everyone coming and grabbing and laying claim to land sooner than the actual statehood, you know, was to come.
And that was you see that in that movie with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, the Oklahoma land grab. You know what that movie is? I can't remember the name.
No, I don't remember.
It's a stupid ass movie. but basically, Tom Cruise's character immigrates from Ireland to go grab a piece of free land in Oklahoma, which was kind of set up to be the opposite of Oregon, which, as we say in Priced Out, our show, Oregon was originally envisioned as a whites-only state, a complete white separatist community, and Oklahoma sort of envisioned as the opposite.
Yeah, as a result of some people owning land and having interest in the oil industry at the time and everything, there was a large concentration of African Americans who were able to start businesses and create community, a rich culture. And then it developed as those black dollars began to circulate and stay within the community. The concentration of millionaires and people who had wealth began to grow. And that created the birth of Black Wall Street. And it took, you know, some unfortunate events that happened one day that started the 1921 race riots, which you gave it a good characterization. I mean, you called it something I never heard anyone call it. And as much as it pains me to hear it described that way, I feel like it's the most accurate way.
You know, looking at the history of this event, the movie was Far and Away.
Yeah, see, I'll never see that.
don't see it. The way I described the riots were it wasn't really a riot. It was an ethnic cleansing, and I didn't mean to say it as to be hyperbolic or to like, you know, just like kind of take an air pump to it or just, you know, just to be incendiary. It really was, you know, what we consider ethnic cleansing or what in old times would be called a pogrom, which is what the Russians would do to Jewish communities and neighborhoods about 100 years ago. Is basically the authorities would sanction a bunch of people or deputize them to go in and destroy homes, to clear out neighborhoods, to retake villages, towns, and farms, and that's really what happened in the riots in Greenwood. You know, you had an accusation of a white woman who said she was raped by a black man. No charges were ever, the charges were dropped, actually. But the city and the state, I'm assuming the county, deputized a bunch of white guys to go in to the neighborhood. And the result was that 40 square blocks were destroyed, burned and looted. 300 people were killed, black people were killed. 9,000 people were left without homes. 9,000 people were left without homes, and officially 1,200 homes were destroyed, including also hospitals, churches, and the place was almost completely razed to the ground. And then they rezoned it so that no one could come back. And they tried to push the neighborhood, the population completely to the north. And that's a pogrom. That's what pogroms were. That's what ethnic cleansing is.
You know, and I think there was a residual effect that they continue to ring for, you know, generations. Like it's sad because this wasn't something that was put in the textbooks. This was something that, you know, it kind of became a little bit of an oral history. And then there began to be a movement where in the 90s, individuals were starting to seek out recognition, both through suing for reparations and doing other things. And the town in itself has done, I would say, in comparison to what it is really a marginal job, but they have done their best to try to recognize this atrocity. Chuck, the police chief, one of the first things he did when he got in place was to speak out and say, give an official apology. But, you know, it was once they were past the chance of having to pay in any kind of legitimate way. So it's like, hey, the signs are up, everything, we've done the most we can do. And by the way, we're sorry for our part in this. And it's created this divide that is still there to some extent. Most African Americans push to one side of the train tracks into Tulsa North, into the North Tulsa area, and to some extent has stayed there, you know, several generations deep. And it's an invisible line for culture, not a line that says you have to stay here. You know, it isn't that oppressive as Jim Crow, but it's an emotional oppression that tells you, okay, your people's here, your culture's here. And that area is now completely has faced a lot of blight and a lot, you know, it's a food desert. And now we're starting to see the beginning stages of individuals coming in and saying, hey, let's fix this area up.
And so, that's, you're talking about now North Tulsa.
Yeah.
But Greenwood itself did survive as a black community. People did sort of take it back.
Yeah. In the 90s, it was, I would say, before the 90s, but there were some things that were taken. There were some businesses that stayed put. The Greenwood Chamber of Commerce made sure that they put a lot of great things in place. And there was always the Black Wall Street, like this small area, this Greenwood district, not a large area in comparison to what it used to be, but there has always been a small area that remained at one point, you know, for us to be able to celebrate that history. That land, that area is now starting to kind of be overtaken. But yeah, there has always been an area in Greenwood that was for that.
And that this history is not past. It's you know, when we talk about gentrification, this community is now the legacy of the quote unquote riot is part of sort of the pattern that gentrification is taking in Tulsa. We were going to talk about a couple of different neighborhoods here. One is Greenwood. One is the Brady Arts District, Blue Dome, Kendall Whittier, and then North Tulsa. And so where does Greenwood sit in relation to downtown? Because we were talking about the last 10 years, there's been a lot of new investment and revitalization, quote unquote, downtown with the sports stadiums. Yeah. And then as we almost always see in mid-sized cities, once the downtown gets to be desirable, then the neighborhoods adjacent to the downtown start to attract a lot of investment. And that's when you start to see people get displaced and gentrified. So how does that roll out in Tulsa, and where does Greenwood sit geographically compared to these neighborhoods?
Well, I think, so for me, what I observe is the BOK Center, when they broke ground on that and began to build that in, I want to say 2006. With the BOK Center, Bank of Oklahoma Center, which is the where they play basketball. It's sort of like an expand, because there's an event center that was always there, but this was the big, we can hold 18,000, bring concerts and other things. That was the first part that said, okay, we're going to revitalize downtown. And that's kind of in the center of downtown. But just off to the side is that historic Greenwood area. And the most interesting thing happened there was a large plot of land there that wasn't really being fully utilized. And the city was able to come in and take that and use it and built One Oak Stadium, which is the baseball, where the minor league baseball team plays. Okay. Now, once that came up in 2010, we began to see the expand, or once the ground broke on that in 2010, we began to see another stage of gentrification kind of sweep through the adjacent areas of downtown. So, for example, the Blue Dome District in 2006, you could go into the Blue Dome District and there's a bar, too, a few clubs, a few different things rotating in and out. It was more of a scene for, you know, young guys, young people to kind of come in, and it's a nice club scene. But all of those clubs began to be pushed out. Some of the diners and the places that you could go that were staples in the Blue Dome area that were just good, you know, like you just knew they were going to be there. They were staples of the old downtown. All of a sudden, their rent skyrocketed. They were pushed out. And some chains came in, and some of the more upscale restaurants came in around it. So what we have is Greenwood is sort of like the center, although it's not physically in the center of downtown. It's actually off to the side. But as soon as that baseball stadium was built, all of a sudden the Brady District became more of a Brady Arts District. Mm-hmm. It went from just being this historic district where it was like, hey, don't touch the buildings, you know, let's keep this the same, to now they're hosting art crawls. They built the Guthrie mm-hmm. Green, which is a hangout where everyone can kind of come and see plays, and they have movie nights, and you know,
that's a pattern of gentrification or revitalization that we see all over the country too. Here in Portland, we have the Pearl District and Alberta Arts, which is right in the heart of the traditional Black community here. But in New Orleans, the Warehouse District is Soho in New York, was gentrified in the 70s. So it really follows a very similar pattern there. Yeah. And the Brady District is named after the family that first attempted to rezone Greenwood and push the existing African-American community up north, right?
Yeah, and there's been controversy over the past few years about that, because once it was discovered that some of the things or once it was brought to light through this new social media era that we live in, that more awareness that, okay, some of the members of the Brady family weren't necessarily too keen on blacks, you know, like that they had a, there was, a, and I don't know all of the facts of it, but there was accusations that there were, you know, that they were active Klan members and things. That, so they renamed the Brady District. It's still the Brady Arts District, but they changed the first name of who it's named after to the less racist Brady, or, you know, so to speak. So it's some awareness of this, of what's going on, you know, what happened in the past. There's so many different layers to it that now if you're not even from Tulsa, you can read about it. You can see that it's insane to think that happened and people were able to get away with it. And then they're even honored by having their name on the community.
It's now just another chapter in the local history of displacement. Now gentrification is front and center. So that's kind of, and the Brady Arts District is right next to Greenwood, right?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, you've got that. You've got that, and then you have we actually in Tulsa have a Pearl District, which is somewhat offset, but it's going through the stages now where it's being completely revamped. We have all of the breweries and the, you know, and everything going on in the Pearl District, where some of the blight is starting to push out some of the blight, and these younger businesses are coming in. So there are a lot of different communities around at the Heritage Heights, and different communities adjacent to downtown are now starting to see the prices of their property starting to skyrocket. One of the things I experienced before moving out of Tulsa was going through the home buying experience and seeing properties that were placed for, you know, on sale for $59,000, $40,000, and then put back on the market after minimal revitalization. Like, I'm talking coat of paint, you know, let's get it up to code. Here's $150,000. You know, this three bedroom with no air conditioning is now $150,000, because you're going to want to live right here. One of the schools that was known for, you know, was a really excellent school with excellent teachers, you know, for years needed funding and other things. But since it's the closest public school to downtown, recently has just undergone an overhaul, where before it was a little bit more difficult to get some of those things passed. So the school system has made adjustments to attract people. You know, they've made exception to the rules. This state, well, you know, you can't come to the school if you don't live in this district. It's like, well, if your parents work in this district or work downtown, you can come here. So
what do people feel about all these changes? I mean, what is the black community? What's been the reaction to all of this last 10 years?
I think there's this weird, and I don't mean this in an insulting way at all. There's this is half and half. There's the people who are outraged, and then there's those who may be apathetic because of the cultural displacement. It's sort of like, we've seen it before, we're not surprised. I'm not even going to apply my energy to stopping the gentrification bandwagon, because it's going to come and go, and I'm still not going to have a grocery store. I'm still going to be in the middle of a food desert. And so it's literally the result of what happens when you create a food desert, and then you say, now let's go pick a fight with the people in the desert. You know, because, you know, there's a certain thing that they're not going to be able to focus their attention on. If you're not in a position of getting fresh food, you're definitely not going to be in contention or have the tools to really make sure that you're fighting against redlining and all the other things that are taking place. So it's a food desert has kind of created, in my opinion, created a distraction, because the African-American community has enough there. They have other uphill battles to fight. And gentrification is so vast, you know, and it has so many different layers that needs to be fought. So I don't think that it's an intentional apathy, like where it's like, oh, we won't speak on it because we don't care. Mm-hmm. I think it's just not long enough arms for that fight.
So it sounds like, you know, we see it like what we saw here in Portland in the 90s and in the first film, Northeast Passage, where you know, new investments coming in, there's not a lot of displacement happening. And people still feel like, well, if I can't afford it here, I can move a little bit further away. I don't feel like I'm outside my community.
Right.
You know, I can still live generally in a place where I see myself reflected in the culture and in the faces.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of other bigger fish to fry, like you were saying. Yeah. You know, in Alberta, in the 90s, it was crime. And what you seem to be saying is like the food desert thing, just getting access to fresh food in North Tulsa, for example, is sort of more of a front and center, maybe a distraction, but people aren't thinking long term about the issue yet.
Yeah, and I think they see it. They're well aware of it. And that's the really good thing, is that it's sort of like, hey, I think there are a lot of people in the community who are saying, hey, let's try to kill two birds with one stone. Let's try to get something passed, or let's try to get these city councilors to work for us. Recently, one of the city councilors who had been in office for years was recently voted out, and was voted out because I believe a younger generation has stepped up and said, okay, look, there's no grocery store. There's other communities being revitalized and they're able to keep portions of their culture. What are you going to do for us? And I think that's a community that's desperate for change and for people who are going to give them change. But because of the recent attention that and the things that have been taught to this generation coming up about Black Wall Street, there's a sense of pride to where they are not going to let go of their culture. So this is going to be a unique fight that we're going to see in Tulsa, because as they start to push into North Tulsa, it's going to be a thing of, there's going to be a lot of community leaders who's going to say, keep our culture. Mm-hmm. I remember that overnight they tried to remove the Black Wall Street sign from the Greenwood, from the strip where Greenwood was. And there were a lot of people who took to social media, who took to the news media and said, no, put our sign back up. You're not going to come in the middle of the night. Put the N back, because, you know, if you're in North, there's an N before the address, before, you know, for the street name.
If like, you're in North Tulsa.
Yeah. So it's like they were like, all of a sudden, Greenwood didn't have the N in front of it.
And they were trying to rebrand North Tulsa as just regular Tulsa.
And there was enough presence in Tulsa, and the generation, I would say around my generation, there's enough people who were making noise to say, no, you won't rebrand this. You won't forget what you've done. You will. There will be a fight on your hand.
That's what we see is, you know, if people take a long vision and you know, organize and resist, then, you know, that's the way forward. And is it Vanessa Hall Harper that you were talking about?
She's one that her vision is, and then the complex nature that we can only imagine that she's had to deal with then now finding out the political side of things, like with her getting in office, and she's got this vision of, no, don't give me, this is something I don't see here at all in the Pacific Northwest. Don't give me dollar stores. You know, don't give me a Dollar General and it counts as a grocery store. Give me a real grocery store with fresh produce, fresh groceries and things that I can get a hold of, you know, meat and things that are sustainable and that could help my family grow.
And that's Vanessa Hall Harper of District 1 of the Tulsa City Council, who represents North Tulsa and who's been advocating or trying to fight these food deserts and fight off a lot of dollar stores, which are these kind of just very cheap stores, cheap. It's like a dollar version of Walmart.
You know what? And the odd thing about it is financially, it's just convenient because financially, it is about the same. You know, you walk in there and you will pay the same prices as if you went somewhere else, if not a little bit more. So it's a little bit of price gouging because they put certain items in there and they say, okay, well, I know you're going to pay a dollar more for this gallon of milk here. And I know this milk is almost expired, but you'll buy it because what else are you going to do? There's nowhere else for you to go and stay in your community.
Well, that seems like that folks there are taking a different track than we did in Portland. Seems like they are starting to take the long view and realize what's going on around them.
Yeah.
Another sort of neighborhood that we're also going to talk about here in another sort of example of Tulsa going a different route than Portland, not making the same mistakes that Portland made, would be Kendall Whittier, which is a neighborhood that is an ethnic neighborhood. It's a Latino, a little bit of a Latino neighborhood, and it's starting to see a lot of quote unquote revitalization. And there's a nonprofit that is headed by Kirk Wester, and it's called Growing Together. And we're going to talk with him in just a second. Working Together is a nonprofit that looks at a bunch of issues all at the same time. It tries to integrate housing, education, and the delivery of social services in an integrated way so that people don't fall through the safety net, in the social safety net, and also that the community, as investment comes in, as a neighborhood gets new investment, that some of that investment is being put deliberately into helping residents grow their own wealth, as well as creating some affordable housing so that they have a stable place to live and don't get displaced by rising prices.
Yeah, I lived in that area and worked when I worked for the city of Tulsa, worked cleaning up that area, doing graffiti abatement exclusively for a whole year. Working in neighbors with the city of Tulsa had me just go in, and this is when they were selling the land, trying to get investors to come in, and they wanted to make it presentable. So my personal tie into that community has been unique because the homeless population was very heavy there, and there's a large Native American population. So that area of town is very unique because you do have African Americans, you do have Latinos. It's truly one of the cultural melting pots of the Tulsa area, because there are some pockets of Kendall Whittier where there are some of the older houses where some of the more affluent people, you know, live in that area too.
Well, let's talk to Kirk. Hi, okay, now we're here with Kirk Wester of Growing Together, which is a community-based nonprofit in Tulsa. And Kirk has been working on, you know, revitalization, education, and housing advocacy as part of a holistic approach to revitalizing communities without displacing the indigenous group that is in that community. And one of the things Kirk talks about is gentrification with justice. Kirk, could you explain what that term means?
Yeah, for us, it means that we have kind of concluded that in order for us to advance the lives of kids and families, that we can't do so in high areas of concentrated poverty. That oftentimes we look at the work that we do, let's take food deserts as a great example, and we lament the fact that we have food deserts, but we actually talk about these as if it you know, it's some kind of rocket science as to how they exist. They exist because there's not disposable income. And so as a result, then how do we look at engaging and garnishing the benefits of what disposable income can provide, but thinking about it in a holistic way so that all people get to take advantage of the stability that community then receives. So as somebody who's personally invested my life and my family in this particular neighborhood back when it was the red light district of Tulsa and now starting to see some change, we can fundamentally see the difference. And now with the partnerships we have, we're working hard to ensure that that benefit is seen by all people, particularly those that have lived here all along.
And to give people a little idea of what's going on in Tulsa, basically, like with many mid-sized cities that started to gentrify or revitalize, there's been a lot of growth and renewal in the downtown area that then started to spill over into neighborhoods that are adjacent to the downtown. So you have the Brady Arts District, which is sort of very kind of similar to the other arts districts, the Pearl District here in Portland or the Warehouse District in New Orleans, where, you know, lofts and industrial buildings were revitalized. And now the neighborhood that you focus on is Kendall Whittier, which is also adjacent to downtown. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of that neighborhood, where it's been, and where you see things going, and how you guys are involved?
Yeah, so we're you know, just one piece of the puzzle. I mean, this revitalization effort started in the early 90s with a lot of community residents just basically saying, look, our neighborhood has gone in disrepair. It's gone in, it's one of the higher concentrated areas of crime in the city. How do we change that? How do we think differently? And so they created Tulsa's first small area master plan. And that master plan began to be a driving policy document for city investment and for public investment in the schools. So it created a new school building, it created a new library, a new post office, and a number of improvements around our core economic district. And so, and then that garnered the attention of the George Kaiser Family Foundation in 2004, 2005, where they began to look for a site for their first new kind of premier early childhood education center. And that investment then began a pretty interesting journey where this very large philanthropic organization took an interest in this community and began to think about how do they help create the infrastructure around which improvements would occur, but at the same time, fundamentally impact the lives and the families of those that they were intending to serve. And so in 2010, Growing Together was formed in collaboration with the George Kaiser Family Foundation and CAP Tulsa, which is an early childhood provider here in Tulsa, with the idea of figuring out what is this, what does it take to ensure large numbers of kids are able to exit poverty, and looking at it from a very holistic perspective. And so, but all along, you know, this work has started very grassroots. It's started by community leaders. It continues to this day to be very much led by community leaders. I myself and my family chose to move into this neighborhood intentionally in 1998. And my wife started at the new school that was being built, her professional career as a teacher. And we've dove in with both feet and investing our kids in our local schools, and trying to be very intentional about how we can, you know, not only be impactful from a professional perspective, but also make sure that the people that we serve are at the center of our work.
So take me back to the 1990s and sort of describe to me what the neighborhood was like, what Kendall Whittier was like, what the population there was like, and, you know, the housing stock, small business community. What was that like?
Yeah, so the Kendall Whittier is a neighborhood that was built in the 20s and 30s. Was actually one of Tulsa's first suburban neighborhoods. The Kendall Whittier Main Street area or business district was considered Tulsa's first suburban business district. But then as time progressed, there became a lot of exits out of our neighborhoods, you know, through the white flight kind of syndrome. There was a highway built right through the middle of our neighborhood, cutting through north and south. And you saw just a lot of disinvestment in the neighborhood. And then the University of Tulsa, which is physically in the neighborhood, also had need for expanded housing opportunities. So a lot of folks came in and began to build just these, you know, small apartment communities that were really poorly designed and fairly not well maintained. And so so you fast forward then to the late 80s, where you've got massive amounts of crime occurring, a significant shift in demographics. It became, in fact, our business district was kind of known as the red light district. We have a historic theater here that was an adult theater, a well-known coffee shop that was an adult bookstore. I mean, this was kind of the centerpiece for the adult entertainment that was happening. And we started to see a pretty large shift in demographics from new immigrants, predominantly from Mexico and Central America. And that thankfully began to stabilize some of the decay in the neighborhood, that families began to come into the neighborhood in large numbers. In fact, for Tulsa, our neighborhood, Kendall Whittier, was kind of considered the entry point for new immigrants coming from Mexico and Central America. And then once they kind of stabilized, they'd move out east. So we actually have one of the highest concentrations of Latinos in the city, though not the highest numbers.
Did you, Andrew, want to talk at all about that history of the community there?
Had lived in Kendall Whittier area for a number of years during my time in Tulsa. It was a community that was rich in Hispanic culture. I often would shop at Las Americas, and that was the closest grocery store for me. And that was one of the, when I saw things I worked with at the City of Tulsa and the Wind Group, always kept me employed to just remove graffiti in that area on those apartment complexes that you had mentioned that are now, you know, now have been torn down. So one of my, my bigger questions I think you just addressed was, my big concern was, as gentrification comes, will this community still keep a rich heritage as far as the Hispanic representation? Because as the, I noticed the Hispanic population moves further east, that's more or less they're living there, but their culture isn't, didn't seem to be as rich and celebrated as it was in Kendall Whittier. There are pockets at 21st and Garnett and other areas where their, you know, businesses are starting together, but there was something more more organic about the placement, the place that they, and the value that they have to the Kendall Whittier area. So similar to what we see with Greenwood, will there ever be anything that, that kind of gives a monument or something that states, hey, this is one of the first landing spots for a lot of the Tulsa Hispanic community?
That's a good question. I don't know that that's ever been considered, but I would say that your question is exactly the question that we're asking. Can this be done? I would say that if it were not for the organizations that are at the table saying that this is a priority for us, this train is going to be moving and will not be caught. And so you have organizations such as the Kendall Whittier Main Street saying, you know, it's not just about businesses, right? It's about businesses that reflect this community. And so you have, you know, your high-end kind of Tata coffee shop right next door to Pancho Naya Bakery, right? Sure. And across the street. And so the question is, can we maintain that fabric? And the critical barrier in my mind, kind of moving into some of the policy questions, is how do you capture and control large amounts of property that are quality and affordable in perpetuity? And to date, that's been one of the biggest questions or barriers by which to create policies that would make that feasible. One of the best ways to do that, in our opinion, is through a community land trust. And that concept here in Tulsa has been really, really struggling to take off. In fact, we've actually had pretty decent amount of pushback to it. And with the idea that you can't stunt the market, blah, 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 that, you know, that at the end of the day, we're the only organization that is wholly committed to the idea of neighborhood and the neighborhood effects, right? Thankfully, we have other partners that are moving along in that way. But at the end of the day, there's no other organization right now that is wholly concerned about keeping a neighborhood intact and serving the folks, particularly those individuals that were here all along. And that we've created a neighborhood that they don't have to say, hey, we're done, we're heading out to, you know, fresher waters, but that they feel compelled to raise their families here. That is a sign of success for us.
It's interesting. It kind of two points. One is that here in Portland, what we've seen about, you know, the cultural conversations around communities that have been dispersed, either voluntarily or forcefully, usually it's both, but the Jewish community here, the Asian community, and now the Black community, as those communities get dispersed, and they all had histories of the city forcefully destroying the areas where they were concentrated. But the idea of how do we hold together a community once it's been dispersed, the idea of a community center often comes up. It's amazing that even though these folks don't really talk to each other, in my reporting, they almost always come back to the same ideas. Like, I wish we had a community center, or that community built a community center, and they can really hold things together with that. So it'd be interesting to see where conversation goes in Tulsa and how far out you're thinking. But in terms of far out thinking, you touched on something that we show in our film, which was in this neighborhood, Albina, Black community in the 1990s, the city had an agenda of building affordable housing because it anticipated there would be displacement. And one of the factors working against it was a lot of NIMBYism from the grassroots level, a lot of bias against affordable housing. And the arguments they would throw up, residents would throw up, was, oh, you're going to attract crime, We need businesses to come back to the area, and if we have a bunch of low-income housing, it won't. It'll, like you say, stunt the marketplace. And that was a big issue, even up until just a couple of years ago. Is that the kind of opposition you're seeing towards the land trust model, or is it a different conversation?
It's a different conversation. In fact, part of our partnership is very much mixed income. We're not working with just affordable partners. We're working with market rate partners as well. Not only are we working with market rate partners, but we're incentivizing those market rate builds to be purchased by key populations or demographics, by individuals who might adopt a different sense of community and adopt this mentality, right? That you're not just you know, selling them out to the general public. So as an example, just to give you kind of some, a little bit more flesh to that. So as our market rate developers building new homes, we're matching, they're providing $4,000 of closing cost assistance. We're matching that with $4,000 of down payment assistance to any teacher who works at one of our three target schools, to any employee of a minority owned business that lives in our, that works in our neighborhood, of any current resident in our neighborhood. And now we're expanding it. We're even adding more money we're creating a tier system to where it's stackable up to $10,000 if you're actually investing your child in our target schools. So we're trying to figure out who are those folks. We also included some of our key partnerships if you're working in the schools, and now a couple of our key faith congregations who have large numbers of community members in their congregation.
Do you want me to go? Do you have any questions? we're just laughing about the next question, which is, I mean, you seem to have a vision for how to create a well-balanced curve of growth, where there's new investment coming in, and yet folks have an opportunity to take advantage of that growth. They have an opportunity to move into home ownership, educational opportunities, so that all boats rise. But there, as gentrification or revitalization starts to move into this area, we have heard from other neighborhood advocates that they're worried that it'll overheat and become, Ed Scherer says he doesn't want it to become drunk Disneyland. Could you explain a little bit about what you think he means by that?
Oh, well, that's Ed. I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. But no, I think the idea is that there is, that there is a lot of potential for us to get over a finish line. In other words, I think that we have the potential with the partnerships and the commitments on the table now to control and large amounts of property that are quality and affordable and remain affordable in perpetuity, while at the same time, as we're currently doing with our partners, investing millions of dollars in our school pipeline every year and looking at how that pipeline over time becomes a drawer of demand. But that the only way that you can truly and successfully ensure that as improvement occurs, that improvement is always kind of buttressed by policies, is around that level and scale of control in the affordability side, right? And so I think that we're on this weird thread, right? This balance, because while at the same time we've had a lot of new investments. I mean, we now have, I think, our fourth brewery that just opened up in the neighborhood, right? You've got a lot of really kind of up and coming, interesting businesses that are coming along. To date, Ed and others have done a good job of making sure that the business district is representative in the neighborhood. But the question is how long can you maintain that if you are not thinking critically about the housing side and on the education side, being thoughtful about how we don't just stick our head in the sand about what's happening, but we'd be very intentional and explicit about what we're trying to achieve, right? Because on the flip side, what I will say, in the education side of the conversation usually goes, I work here to serve low-income kids, right? And basically said, my goal is not necessarily for the improvement of kids. My goal is to serve my own kind of esocentric needs, to serve low-income kids. Even if the evidence is showing that if you have a mixed income school, that oftentimes all ships rise with the tide, right? In fact, what we've seen in the city of Tulsa and Tulsa Public Schools, that if you can lower free and reduced lunch to about 70%, but not lower than 55%, suddenly you start to see aggregate scores begin to rise. And I believe there's two reasons for that. One of those reasons is because you are actually saying, right now we're saying, this is an insane notion that we do, and this is an insane notion that's propagated by the oftentimes the very folks that are doing it. We're saying, let's say you're the best teacher in the country at kindergarten. What we know is that kids who are coming from high concentrated poverty circumstances are on par, on average, coming in 2 to 3 years behind their middle income peers, day one of kindergarten. And I'm saying to that teacher, you get that kid caught up two to three years in a single year. Oh, and by the way, 95% to 100% of your kids are coming in that way, right? Because they're coming from neighborhoods by which are propagating that deficit. This isn't, in the notion though, is we often go think that this is a parent problem, right? That somehow these low-income parents don't have the capacity to teach their kids, and that's why they're behind. No, they're behind because of the environment by which they're living and the challenges to bandwidth that parents have that are in those situations to be able to dedicate to the child's advancement. And so we think there's a ratio issue. So you change that ratio. Now all of a sudden I'm saying about 65, 70% of your kids are coming in this. Okay, that's tangible. That's potentially chewable. Oh, and by the way, what we are seeing too is that the data is starting to show that if kids can come from solid, mixed income, stable communities, even if they're in high poverty circumstances, that suddenly that 2 to 3 year gap starts to shrink to about 6 months to a year, right? That just by the nature of growing up in a stable community environment is reaping dividends on your actual achievement and the types of vulnerabilities that you're experiencing as a child. And so you enter into that school. Now all of a sudden I'm saying to you, great teacher, only about 60% of your kids are coming this way. Oh, and they're only about 6 months to a year behind instead of 2 to 3, right? That all of a sudden seems achievable. So what I'm suggesting is that communities should be self-sustaining and self-healing. That over time, we shouldn't need this kind of charity mentality that we just basically concentrate everybody who isn't like us. And then we also propagate the exact same problem by those of us with means making the exact same choices to segregate ourselves from those that don't. And then we make ourselves feel better by diving into these neighborhoods and saying, that's the population I choose to serve. And if you're gonna change that population, I'm out, right? What I've discovered too, and this is kind of the last point, and I know I'm kind of going on and on about this, but this is an incredibly important point that I would say we've learned as a family, because when we first came into this neighborhood, we came in with a great, great sense of arrogance that we're going to change the world, right? Like the typical white savior syndrome was all over this person, right? What I discovered in some significant challenging times of pain and turmoil that we had with looking at ourselves saying, I'm out, let's go move out to the suburbs and be done with this. What I discovered is that the exact people that I thought I was impacting were the ones that came and cared for this guy, right? That loved on me and cared for me and fundamentally opened my eyes to realize that it's this person that's receiving the benefit of being here. And what I'm saying is that I believe that the benefit of these neighborhoods that are mixed income has the strong potential to be bidirectional. And it's not just the benefit that folks with means are coming into this neighborhood, but if they allow it, it's the folks that are challenged financially to be able to invest and impact the lives of those that do have means. And that number one impact is with our kids.
That's good.
We cannot possibly think about addressing the issues of racism and socioeconomic disparities when we fundamentally do not know and are not impacted by those people that are different from us. And as long as they're not within our social network, and I'm talking about close, intimate social network, I don't understand how we could even fathom making a dent or difference in the challenges that we're experiencing as a community and as a country going forward around issues of race.
And doing that by promoting and sustaining mixed income communities.
That's correct. That's correct. And doing so in, like I said, very intentional way and being, you know, calling out when we're not being successful and celebrating success when we are and making sure that community members are at the table when decisions are being made all along the process. And that's the role that we play. And that's a role that we insist on. And sometimes it's popular and sometimes it's not. But, you know, that's just the nature of the game. Thankfully, we've got amazing partners at the table you know, right now that are buying into this idea, that are changing the way in which they're operating. As an example, Habitat for Humanity that I already raised earlier, I mean, they're even going so far to say that we want to prioritize, first and foremost, if you have a child in one of our schools, you're top of the list to get a home from us, right? And so it's not just about creating more housing, it's about creating more housing that has a fundamental different impact on kids. And asking the question, can we create a plausible solution for kids to exit poverty? And if we can, and if we're right, this fundamentally changes the conversation about how we address poverty.
So this is a very integrated social service model, data-driven, looking at education, business development, and also housing all at the same time. Again, trying to get all those boats to rise at the same time when investment does come into an area.
That's the hope. That's the hope. I mean, certainly our focus has mostly been on the education and the housing side, and we've got the amazing benefit of a economic development partner that we're coordinating with. But yes, that's the hope. And it's a big question. All of these questions that you're asking are certainly looming in front of us. And, you know, I'm hopeful that that the question is in the affirmative for our families. But I do know that it won't be if there's not somebody monitoring and checking on it and driving that mission forward.
Well, we hope certainly that you get a lot of grassroots and institutional support for these efforts. It seems like you guys really have a long-term vision on how this neighborhood could do things differently than, say, Portland. And folks can see more of you and hear more about your projects on the 26th, February 26th, at the Greenwood Cultural Center after the screening of Priced Out. And that's Kirk Wester, recovering white savior of Growing Together.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Look forward to seeing the movie.
And we're back. And once again, good job, man. I felt like it was no point me being there. Like you hammered it. You had some good questions. And Kurt knocked it out the park with some really good answers. And I'm really proud of the work that he's doing. Kirk is the person that I had actually met multiple times down through the years. I worked with his father, and his father would always give me updates on the work that he was doing. And so now, looking back, you know, 2,000 miles away, I now get a different perspective on how effective he is actually being in that community, covering more than just housing, but the actual people with the work that he's doing.
Yeah, it's pretty inspiring. And we certainly hope that more folks in Tulsa and Oklahoma can support those efforts, because they're small right now, but they're looking to scale up. And it's important to note also that he is kind of a local site for a more national movement called Purpose Built Communities. And they're doing the same model in different cities around the country. And that's a movement that's actually coming out of Atlanta. So it's actually, you know, has its roots in, you know, one of the great cities of the country that wants to do gentrification differently. They want to see communities get revitalized, not simply rebuilt with a new population.
Yeah.
So lots of luck to Kirk and to his efforts, and we'll be following this purpose-built community movement in other cities.
Yeah, definitely will. Once again, when is the screening for Priced Out in Oklahoma, in Tulsa?
It's on February 26th at the Greenwood Community Center.
Yeah. The Greenwood Cultural Center is if you ever get a chance to go, man, it's one of the greatest places that you'll ever, I mean, it's just a lot of history just hung up on the walls. A lot of great stuff there.
Yeah, please do. If you're in Tulsa and you can hear the sound of our voices and see our faces, it's at 7 p.m. on Monday, February 26th. Or if you're in Portland and we get this podcast up soon enough, there is another showing that will be going on February 22nd on 1531 Northeast 23rd Avenue, just off Alberta Street, at a place called Saramon House. Doors open at 6:30, and then the show starts at 7.
All right. So, man, this weekend I went to go see Black Panther. We talked about it on last week's podcast, because I went on Thursday, but then I went again Monday with my son. with both of my sons. So it's like me and my wife went, and just the tremendous amount of emotions walking out of the theater, like a pride. And then Monday going back, and the excitement on the boys' faces, especially like my oldest son, he's like, his mind gets to churning right away. And he's like trying to identify what he just saw, you know, like, and how he can really put a language to it, because it's more than entertainment. It provokes thought. And for me, it was one of the first times from a superhero standpoint that we saw a superhero, I felt like, who took on, he took on the emotions and the ideas of an enemy. Like, he didn't just take on this great ominous figure who like has to be defeated and we can't see. Like, you could see the actual villain that he had to take on was vulnerable. And so you knew he could be defeated. But there was something bigger that he was fighting tradition. And so the Black Panther legacy, the movies are going to create a legacy of maybe provoking thought and maybe provoke a generation to say, let's fight tradition if tradition is on the wrong side of equality and tradition is on the wrong side of justice. And so I was really proud to see that a genre that takes so many different faces and brings them in used a Black face to say, hey, we're going to provoke thought. We're going to actually have you thinking. Like, you know, in the past, there's been that small little social justice moment, that little aha, mm-hmm. you know, almost an Easter egg. Like, you had to be watching it and pay close attention. Oh, that's what Tony Stark was saying. But This was overt. Like, this was just clearly, blatantly in your face that, like, look, we have to start stepping up and fighting the traditions that may be self-preserving but tearing down other countries and other communities. So
yeah, it's very high. It took the high road, you know, because the villain had a vision of for Black liberation. He wanted to defend, you know, Black people around the world, right? Which is kind of like Magneto's character in the X-Men series. Yeah. He wants to defend mutants, right? So it's almost like a good vision, right? But yeah. But the good guys always, in both scenarios, say, well, that's a good vision, but we have to take the higher road. We can't become the enemy. But we can't defend ourselves against the enemy by sinking to their level and using their methods, using violent means. We need to go higher. We need to go high when they go low. And I just thought that was a beautiful message and a courageous message to be talking about.
It was overall, it gave people a sense of pride. It's provoked thought. So I'm excited. You know, I've seen it twice and I plan on buying it and really can't wait to buy it with the commentary and watch it and really listen to what was some thoughts behind the different scenes and see if it matches what I'm thinking, you know? Yeah.
I mean, we heard, just the other day, because we had the show on Friday, a Priced Out show in at SCI, Black Community Center here, and we went head to head with Black Panther that night, right? Yeah. But then I heard from someone who had been at Black Panther after going to see Priced Out, and they said, yeah, I need to go see Black Panther after seeing Priced Out. I needed something to pick up my spirits. And it's just an uplifting movie. People just come away with a smile and just like rooting for the good guys.
Yeah, I definitely would say I'm all for this movement where they're saying, hey, bring kids to the movies to see it. Mm-hmm. Because it brought alive in me was that little kid that said, I want to make movies. You know, mm-hmm. like that's a voice that once you get older and you find out everything that it takes to make a movie, mm-hmm. you feel like, all right, I just need to learn to make one part of a movie at a time. Or you scale it down because reality hits you. And it's like, oh, they have to spend a lot of their own money, huh? Like, and so
it takes a lot.
Yeah. And so for me, it re-sparked that thought that it was like he worked with so many different studios, largest budget ever given to an African-American, period, to make a film. and one of Marvel's largest budgets, too. So it's like, and he's
a family friendly film. It's really not very. It's not
no
like
cursing, gory. No nudity. Yeah.
Yep. It is. There's no like gore or swearing, really.
Yeah. So I would definitely suggest it gets our endorsement, but you know, maybe I don't know. I don't even see how you could be mad at it. You know how some people. All right, you're a little bit too conservative if you're mad at this.
Yeah, man, it's like, yeah, it's a good time, man. I mean, it's great even just to be in the theater with the crowd and just feel all like the good energy. It feels great just to even be there. Thank you so much, Andrew. And hopefully next week we'll have either some of the conversations that we've been having in these panel discussions after screenings, or we'll also be posting deleted scenes and extended scene versions of things that actually are in Priced Out. Normally some of these deleted scenes go on DVDs, and unless you buy the DVDs, you don't see them. But we're going to go a different route. We're just going to start posting them onto our YouTube channel. And so you can see us, you can see some of the film right there in its rawest, believe me, a rawest form imaginable. So look forward to that too.
All right. See you next time.